don't need a creepy, possessive Svengali to teach me how to appreciate the finer things in life, especially when it comes to coffee. I know that the secret to the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But how do you know when the coffee you're buying was roasted? Well, make it easy and switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. Best of all, they deliver this coffee to your home or office or remote country cottage within a week of custom roasting it so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. I promise you will taste the difference. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Good day, movie lovers, and thanks for imbibing a little dose of the Next 100 Project, the every Monday podcast that reviews the classics. Fair warning, our podcasts spoil all kinds of films. My handle is Ryan Ellis, and here to my right is the dame who has never, at least to my knowledge, come back from the dead, my beloved spouse, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, simply named Laura. And Laura is renowned for its music. In fact, it was 7th on AFI's list of the top 25 music scores. Yet David Raxon's tunes didn't even receive an Oscar nomination in 1944. How many others in the top 25 didn't get an Oscar nomination for the music?
It's just 3 more, so 4 in total. Is that what you got?
I've got 4 more. What do you got there, though?
Okay, so King Kong, but there was no category at the time, so it's not that much of an outrage.
That's right.
The other two I've got are absolutely surprising because they're big classics now. Vertigo, although that film was not really successful when it first came out, so I guess that's what hurt it. But then the next one is crazy. It's The Godfather. But meanwhile, Godfather Part 2, that famous music won the Oscar.
The one you're missing is Psycho.
Oh my God, how did I not catch Psycho on the list?
None of the Bernard Herrmann scores for Alfred Hitchcock were nominated for Oscars. Isn't that shocking?
Come on.
Not just Psycho and Vertigo, but any of the other ones they worked on together.
That is criminal. Mm-hmm.
And a bit of a note for both The Godfather and King Kong. You said already King Kong couldn't have been nominated. There was no category for music back then. That's true. The Godfather was nominated, but then it was rescinded when they found out that Nina Rota's music, at least some of it, was used in a previous score for Fellini. Rota and Fellini worked a lot together. So I guess it's not original.
Yeah, but Godfather 2, it's all derivative from Godfather.
I know, isn't that ironic? Well, yeah, it's just like John Williams gets nominated for, or used to get nominated for, the Star Wars movies and the Indiana Jones movies, the sequels. And yet the music sometimes was different. The Imperial March is in Empire Strikes Back, of course, but not the first Star Wars movie. But most of the music is derivative of the very first one in all those cases, and yet he was nominated multiple times, so I don't know. Okay, the Next 100 Project's 65th movie-type movie, Laura, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, and of course it didn't make it, or else we wouldn't be talking about it anymore. 20th Century Fox, another Fox movie this year, released it in November 1944. It was not a monster hit, but it did okay. Bev, remind people what it's about with the skinny, because it is an old movie, 1944, so long ago.
And a pretty convoluted plot to boot.
Yeah.
Jean Tierney is Laura, a beautiful, successful New York ad exec who's just been shot dead in her apartment. Dana Andrews is Detective Mark McPherson, trying to figure out if the murderer was Laura's playboy fiancé, Shelby Carpenter, Laura's aunt and Shelby's secret lover, Anne Treadwell, or her possessive meddling mentor, Waldo Lydecker. The plot thickens when Laura herself reappears unscathed, going from murder victim to suspect.
And those three characters you mentioned in order, Vincent Price plays Shelby.
Mm-hmm.
The aunt is Judith Anderson from Rebecca, and then later went on to play the High Priestess, whatever they call her, the Vulcan High Priestess, that is, in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. And then Waldo is wonderfully played by Clifton Webb.
In a way, he's kind of the star of the movie.
Oh, he is the star of the movie. Right? By a mile, really. Dana Andrews and Jean Tierney are great actors, or at least good actors.
They're good.
But they're overshadowed by him. Okay, in a nutshell, writer wastes wrong woman. Ad executive actually alive. Cop cracks clock concealment. I had a hard time coming up with a nutshell for this one, but I went with alliteration. That's usually a fun way to go. Okay, some Rotten Tomatoes numbers first. The critics, 100% of them, liked the movie. 60 fresh, 0 rotten, and 91% of audiences. So pretty damn good scores for this old movie. And we're back in the era of hats and trench coats. We haven't done a movie back around this point in quite a long time, a mystery noir type film at least.
We have a friend who calls them high pants, fast talking films. High pants, fast talking.
So what'd you think of Laura?
Admittedly, now that I've seen Laura a few times, I'm every time a little more annoyed by all the red herrings. Mostly because I know that they're coming and then they just kind of seem like silly distractions. And I agree that Jean Tierney, while she's very good, may have been a little miscast as the title character, but I still love Laura. It's a film you can just sink your teeth right into, and there's no underestimating the watchability of Clifton Webb as Waldo Leidecker. One of those films that indulges all your guilty pleasures without ever making you feel dumb.
I like the movie a lot too, but I don't know that the plot has held up as the viewings have happened over and over again. Yeah,
it's definitely the weakest thing about it.
But there's some interesting things with the plotting, because we jump right into the story. There's not much intro to Mark McPherson. It's not even an hour and a half long, by the way. It's about an hour and 28 minutes long. He's the main character, but we don't learn much of anything about him, especially at the beginning. The murderer is the narrator, and we don't know that so early on, but that is Waldo. That's a technique they use in the same year, Double Indemnity, one of the other great mysteries of all time, where you've got a murderer is narrating the movie, although we know he's the murderer. He's admitting it in the very first scene. And Mark meets that killer right off the bat, Waldo, in the bath. He just doesn't know that's his man yet. And being in the bath is a technique that Dalton Trumbo, the real writer, he wrote in the bath. And, of course, the movie that they made Trumbo, he wrote in the bath also.
Oh, my God. It made me uncomfortable to watch. Who would want to sit in the bath for so long that they need to pull up a typewriter?
Very pruned.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, of course, they don't show his nudity. They couldn't show men or women being naked in the 40s. But when Waldo gets out of the bath and they pan away, that's a very disarming technique to do to the cop. This guy is standing there naked and wet. That could make him feel vulnerable, but because he's Waldo Leidecker, it's almost like he has the upper hand, even though he's wet and naked in front of this guy who is an official of the state who could arrest him. And as we later learn in the movie, he would arrest him had Waldo not died at the end of the film.
And it's like this amazing twisted power move, especially for the 40s when people were so much more prudish.
And this guy is pretty obviously closeted. The actual actor, Clifton Webb, was gay, and he's playing the guy pretty prissily. I think he's supposed to be gay, but actually wants Laura. For some reason, she could turn him around, if you will.
I see it as Laura being a possession.
Oh, yeah. Everybody objectifies this woman.
Yeah. It's a wonderful twist when we meet her halfway through the film, and then we meet this woman who's not really anything like the woman that's been described to us. And of course, she's her own person and she has a very strong character of her own, which is incredibly refreshing. And I think one of the things that makes the movie enduring, and probably one of the reasons it's one of my favorite noirs, because it has this legitimately, well, actually, a lot of noirs have great, strong female characters. Mm. But she's not a damsel. She doesn't need to be rescued. I mean, she does need to be rescued, but she doesn't run into Mark's arms and say, you know, save me from this murderer. She just has this really strong personality of her own. And she resents Waldo's possessiveness.
Machinations,
yeah, that's a great word for it.
Even though he helped her get to where she is today, but he's not the only reason she got to that point. Because she is a successful ad executive, she must have some brains. That's a job you see now that's a Meg Ryan, Katherine Heigl thing. She's in advertising. I guess men do it too in movies all the time.
Yeah, women.
Well, Mad Men's all about that.
Yeah, women work for fashion magazines, television shows, or advertising, and men are architects. I think they're only architects. Movies would have you believe that architecture is 50% of employment for males.
George Costanza's dream come true. I always wanted to pretend I was an architect, Jerry. The movie's set in New York City, one of the rare movies we've had in a while that's set there. Now, Saturday Night Fever we covered not that long ago, and that's more Brooklyn. So I guess this is the first since Moonstruck that we've had. We're going to have more pretty soon set in New York, in Manhattan specifically.
Is there any scene set in the outdoors of Manhattan?
Like, well, you see the outside. I say that it doesn't matter. It could have been just done in LA.
It's all soundstages.
It was probably in LA. Yeah.
Even the drive to the country cottage might have been a soundstage for my memory of not really being the most convincing location. So yes, it's set in New York, but it truly is a studio picture through and through.
But it has a New York feel, at least, I thought. Right away, the movie draws attention to the clock in the opening scene where Waldo stores the gun. It's funny how you don't know it then, but you're hearing the narration of the murderer, and the cop is interviewing the guy that will later become the only suspect in the whole case, and then we're seeing, we don't know then, that that's where the gun is. Right there, hello, tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock.
It's a great thing for when you're watching the movie a second or third time.
This movie does reward multiple viewings, for sure.
Yeah, and so many scenes take place in her apartment, and to think the murder weapon is right there with them.
hidden away under a lock and key, except it gets kicked in pretty easily by Mark. I like that, too. Dana Andrews doesn't have a lot to do in this movie, really, especially when it comes to being a tough cop. But he's got to kick that thing open to get that gun out of there.
Quite a move to make for what is essentially a guess or a curiosity. He just wants to see if there's anything in the clock. The clock is presumably valuable. We don't know that Lydecker, he's a suspect, but we don't know at this point that he did anything. It's just a suspicion. Near the beginning of the film, Lydecker wants to take a few objects out of the apartment because he claims that they're his and the clock is one of them. So I can totally see why he would have suspicions. But in many ways, McPherson is actually a terrible cop. And one of the things he does is fall destroy for the property. Well, falling for the woman is like, he can't help doing that in a way. At least that's unintentional. He lets Lydecker tag along to suspect interviews. He interferes with the crime scene, smokes all over.
Oh, I love that. Helps and drinks on the job.
Helps himself to booze from the victim's liquor cabinet, even after it's been determined that a bottle of whiskey from that bar is a piece of evidence. And then once he does discover the gun and the clock, he returns the weapon to its hiding place and is like, I'll see you in the morning. Why?
Maybe Waldo will come to try to shoot you and I'll stop him. What if you're a second late?
That's not what cops do. They're not like, yawn, I'll arrest him tomorrow.
I think the idea is he's got to get Waldo to come in and try to shoot Laura again, which he does do. But that doesn't seem like a very smart move because, like I just said, he might have been a little late and then Laura is dead. Isn't it interesting that a guy like Waldo, this effete, very smart, rich man, is going to use a shotgun to kill somebody?
Yeah, it's a strange weapon for him, I would
think. But the only reason why they did, I think, is because then you could have the other woman, the model, have her face blown apart, and she's wearing Laura's clothes, so everyone assumes it's just Laura.
Yeah, you can't get that circumstance with a pistol or poison or slit throat. Or I don't know how a man like Lydecker would normally murder someone.
So maybe he actually did think it through and thought, this is the way I've got to do it. Although he thinks he's shooting Laura. No, that doesn't make sense, does it? Well, we're saying the plot doesn't necessarily hold up in this movie.
Yeah, and as great as his character is, and it is fabulous, and I don't really doubt that he's a sinister bad man, him being capable of shooting a woman in the face point blank does seem like a bit of a stretch considering his behavior.
Just because of the old, if I can't have you, no one will.
But you think then he would just destroy her in the paper or something, which destroy he could her do. Reputation, which he's done to her suitors already.
And we're going to cover a movie just like that in a few weeks, destroying people through the press in Sweet Smell of Success, one of my favorite movies. That is very much a New York movie, and that actually is set in New York and takes place in New York.
But other than that, I think the movie actually does a pretty good job, especially for the 40s, of portraying that kind of possessiveness and that kind of abusive one-sided relationship of a man. He buys her everything, he helps her career, he does all these things so that she'll owe him, and then in return he expects her to give him all of her free time. She eats dinner with him 7 days a week. He's like, we went out 5 days a week and then the other two nights we'd stay in, and she can only date the men she can't date anybody, as a matter of fact. He makes sure she doesn't date anybody. He ruins anybody who comes near her, ruins their reputation. Just can't be her own person at all. She's like his little personal plaything.
I think the way that Clifton Webb plays the character is very similar to what George Saunders does in All About Eve. You've got this guy who is arguably gay, but he seems to want women. And it's implied in All About Eve that the George Saunders character wants sexually to have a piece of Ann Baxter.
And he's also a reporter. He's a gossip columnist.
Yeah, who also could bury people if they don't get... Well, he also has information about her. That's why he gets what he wants with her. So isn't that an interesting technique, and isn't that questionable? What do these guys really want with these women? Is it sexual? Is this a movie that was, in both cases, so long ago you couldn't have sex scenes, but did they want these women that way?
It's a really good question. Did they have a sexual relationship? I think the answer seems like it's obviously no. She doesn't seem to feel any ways about seeing other men, even though she spends all this time with Lydecker. The movie seems to imply that no, they never consummated their relationship. It's just kind of about this weird Vertigo style of possession. And like Vertigo, he also makes her over, you know? He buys her clothes, he furnishes her apartment. While we're on it, we can tip our hat to the production design.
Since we're nominated for an Oscar, too.
They're beautiful, they're incredible, they're ornate, and there's this definite similarity between Laura's apartment and Lydecker's, even for the 40s. It was a very old-fashioned, upper-class style. Mm. It's funny that he has this problem with the relationship that Laura initially develops with the artist who paints her portrait. Even though they don't say it, it seems to me that Laura wouldn't have had her portrait painted. He's the one that wanted a gigantic portrait of Laura made in the first place.
That picture is a photo done over with oil paint. That's why it has that weird look to it. And of course, the movie's black and white. You can't really tell if there are any kind of flaws that the color might have done. But I wish I had an oil painting on myself above our fireplace.
Well, we're just going to have to make that happen.
I guess I'm just not that vain. Plus, we don't have a fireplace.
Yeah. Now, do you think Lidecker has the hots for McPherson at all, considering the way he greets him?
Maybe so.
Or do you
so.
Think he's maybe using his... I guess homosexuality is implied. We can just say he's a gay character, but it seems pretty strongly implied that he's gay. He seems to be keenly aware of how that can make certain people uncomfortable, and that's why he uses his nudity and his effeteness in McPherson's face. He puts it right out there and tries to actively make him uncomfortable. It probably helps him get away with all kinds of things because people would be so uncomfortable around him because of that.
I think you could argue he should lay low, considering he knows he's the one who actually did it, so why is he involved in everything? That's also two things. The arrogance of this man. And it's a movie, and the movie needs him to tag along, or else really how does Mark figure all these things out? He probably doesn't if Waldo is just living his life and being involved in some ways, but not always being there.
He may also want to display his sexuality to McPherson to put off any suspicion on him, because if he says, oh, well, there's no way that these two have an actual sexual relationship, then the idea of jealousy may not play into the cop's mind of what would motivate him to murder her.
It's fun to think, too, that the backstory, if I don't think this is true, I never read this, and there's a lot of information about this movie online, but Otto Preminger, who did direct and also produce, he was just a producer, and then Ruben Mamoulian was fired by Zanuck, Daryl Zanuck, that is, during production. I guess he wasn't doing a very good job, and Preminger took over, which apparently he wanted to do in the first place. So I'm not saying Preminger did this, but maybe it's the same kind of thing as what was in Ben-Hur, where William Wyler had Stephen Boyd play the relationship he had with Charlton Heston as if they're old lovers. Heston didn't agree with it then. He doesn't agree with it now. He didn't know that was in the screenplay that Gore Vidal rewrote, but Boyd was playing as if he's a spurned lover. So maybe the idea here is the same thing, where Dana Andrews wasn't told, this guy's going to have the hots for you. But Clifton Webb was told that, possibly.
He fought to cast him, and the reason that the production didn't want to cast him was because he was gay and because he came across as gay, and they didn't want the character to come across that way. Apparently he's not written that way in the book.
Mm.
And in the book, as a matter of fact, Lidecker is a much more minor character, and one of the biggest changes that Preminger made was to give him a bigger role in the film in general and to make him the most interesting character in the film, which he absolutely is. He's a great villain. And speaking of gay men as villains, this is a trope of Hollywood still probably today. It's kind of a sinister thing that Hollywood does to persistently cast gay men as villains.
Or gay people, because you said Vertigo a few minutes ago. This is one of the few influences of or from this movie I could find. The sexual obsession thing with Mark and Waldo in this movie towards Laura. And of course, the sexual obsession is obviously the plotline of Vertigo. But then Basic Instinct was definitely influenced by Vertigo. Paul Verhoeven in the commentary talks about how a lot of the stuff, including the outfits, are supposed to match some of the outfits from Vertigo and Basic Instinct. And what's the big controversy about that film? Not just the sex scenes, but that the gay lover, the lesbian lover, was a violent killer. And people were outraged about that in 1992. I saw that movie in the theater in 1992, and there were no people protesting outside of mine, but then it's also Canada. But in all three movies, Laura, Vertigo, Basic Instinct, you've got, well, maybe more so Laura and Basic Instinct, but the gay characters are the killers.
Yeah, and for decades in Hollywood, the only time that gay people were going to see themselves represented in film was either as the villain or a total joke. It's covered beautifully in an excellent film, which if you're a film lover, you've probably already seen. If you haven't, run, don't walk, see Celluloid Closet, which is based on an excellent book about the portrayal of homosexuals in Hollywood. It's a really great exploration. This film, Laura, is super guilty of it.
Yeah. Mark acts like he's not enthralled with the painting of Laura at first, so it's not love at first sight. But then he seems to fall in love with the painting of Laura and the descriptions of Laura before he ever meets her. It's a weird thing. That was my original skinny, which is if you fall in love with a painting, you're not in love, dude. You're in lust. And I don't blame him, because Jean Tierney's one of the great beauties in the history of the business. She was modest about her performance in this movie. She didn't think she was all that great. She's got great poise, which I guess is typical back in those days. Most actresses did. She's a true beauty who transcends eras. I prefer modern actresses, both from an acting standpoint, but more importantly, from a look standpoint. Generally, I find them just simply be more attractive. People say Elizabeth Taylor is the best beauty in the history of Hollywood. I would put her in my top 30. But Jean Tierney? Yep.
Oh, no, she's an absolute knockout. In that respect, it's clear why she was cast. And I think she does a good job of playing somebody who's good at navigating those waters. And by that, I mean she plays the part like somebody who is accustomed to all kinds of attention, whether it's appropriate or inappropriate, not just from men who are sexually attracted to her and it just being kind of this consistent wall of them that she has to deal with, and that's assumed that they're going to want her, but even women. Her housekeeper is strangely obsessed with her. And she handles all the attention with this kind of expertise. She is a beautiful woman. She was probably personally very accustomed to all kinds of attention.
She was method acting.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't really have to stretch that far to understand what it would be like for Laura to cope with all this inappropriateness. But other than that, I don't know if she really has the je ne sais quoi to rationalize just the level of obsession with her from everybody in her life, maybe with the exception of her aunt. But then her aunt, while she doesn't seem to fall prey to that, also understands that her lover is just going to want to be with Laura and there seems to be nothing she can do about it. She can entreat to Laura, hey, why don't you give him to me? But there's no scene of her saying to Shelby, pick me over Laura. It's almost like an absurd thing. No, no. Of course she has to share him with Laura. If Laura will have him, then she doesn't stand a chance because she's just that great. I joked to you when the movie was over that she's like the one true ring to lead them all. McPherson is Frodo and Lydecker is Sauron.
Sauron.
And the housekeeper is Gollum. She's so...
My precious Jesus.
So over the top. I mean, she is playing to the cheap seats. Although, it doesn't matter. She's not in the movie that much. As far as the leads go, the weakest performance is Dana Andrews as McPherson. I don't know. He's just very wooden, and he's just always has this wry smile on his face, passing for thoughtfulness.
One thing I want to say about Jean Tierney before we move on to Dana Andrews, if you want to see her be really good in something and be a great villain herself, watch Leave Her to Heaven, which was, I believe, the very next year, 1945, I think it was, or 46, one of those two. You and our listeners, check that movie out if you haven't seen it already.
I liked her very much in Laura. I think the problem truly is that the part is just too much of a tall order. And it's clear that they didn't have a budget for big stars.
Well, she's not in the movie
both
that...
Both her and Dana Andrews are newcomers.
She's not in the movie all that much, though. And that's maybe part of the problem is that she doesn't have a lot of time to do anything. The movie's about halfway over before she reappears. She does reappear when Mark has fallen asleep. Is the rest of the movie all a dream that Mark McPherson's having? Laura's alive after all. Let's
and
solve
I save
the murder.
Her, yeah. Oh my God, which is also my theory about Vertigo, you guys.
Yeah,
check out the podcast if you want more details. Mm-hmm. So the second half of Vertigo could possibly be his manic, crazy dream.
That one makes even more sense than my theory about this one. So Dana Andrews was always working in this era. A lot of actors were, but you look at his filmography in the early 40s into the mid 40s, 3 and 4 or 5 movies a year. If you don't remember this, he was in The Best Years of Our Lives.
I did not remember that. It's been years since we covered that movie.
That's right. That was his AFI movie. And then also the year before this, he was in The Oxbow Incident with Henry Fonda. A very good film, which I believe is still free on YouTube. We have the DVD, but for those who maybe don't and want to see it, really short film, excellent movie about hanging people that may not be guilty of anything and the justice of that or the lack of justice in that film. So he's got a good resume with those three movies, including this one, Laura, but maybe not the greatest actor of all time. His character's always playing with that marble baseball game, and I wonder if that's Mark's little addiction. It'd be like chewing tobacco or snorting coke, maybe.
Or an iPhone. I kind of want to play this movie for everybody who's like, everybody's looking at their phones now. No, everybody have ways to distract themselves always.
During the investigation, he's playing with that stupid little game, too. It's not like he's just in his office. People are talking, and, okay, let me get that marble thing to go here.
It helps him concentrate.
Yeah.
It's like his fidget spinner.
Well, and speaking of the investigation, whenever villains or murderers are discussed, Waldo appears. Another tip-off the movie's giving you, I guess, without actually being obvious about it. When you first saw the film, I don't remember this, but did you pick up that Waldo was the killer?
No way. Right. The red herrings are ridiculous, and they are more intent on keeping the audience guessing than on really making it a cohesive plot. Why does Shelby fall asleep at the symphony and then lie about it? Or Laura gets her radio repaired but fails to mention it to McPherson until she's forced to, even though the repairman could have backed up her story. You are under investigation for murder. Why aren't you upfront with all this information? So it's just a little too much. And then even the characters behave suspiciously. The actors seem to be intentionally performing to be suspicious, just to mislead the audience. I liked the revelation that Shelby was the killer. He seems like the most appropriate person. And I like that somebody who thinks he's doing a good thing or acting as if he did all these wonderful things for Laura is revealed to have actually had such selfish motivations that he would kill her. So I find it like an elegant ending. But if you watch this movie blind, you could not possibly guess he was a killer.
Well, if you watch this movie now and didn't know what we're giving away, which is that Waldo did it, Vincent Price has such baggage, in a good way, that came later. All the horror schlock he did, the 1958 version of The Fly, there's even a line about how he doesn't have enough courage to kill a fly, and then later went on to be in that film. But all the history he had, of course, being the voice in Thriller, Michael Jackson's song, and Edward Scissorhands, all those films. So if you went into this one, you got to think Vincent Price is the bad guy. How could he not be? He's already a weirdo actor, and he's got all those horror things in his resume. And he, by the way, thought this was his best film of all of those movies he ever made, including one of your favorites, Edward Scissorhands.
I like Edward Scissorhands a lot, but Lore's a better movie. And
yeah, well, I agree.
As much as he was an iconic actor for all those horror movies he made, none of them were really considered excellent.
No, but I'm saying that you watch a guy like Vincent Price, or if you were to see Peter Cushing, or any of those kinds of guys in movies that came later on, and they weren't supposed to be the bad guy, but if you cast them and watch the movie many years later, it's one of those things you can't know then, making the movie, but if you come back to it years after, well, of course he's the guy. He was always the guy.
Although back when he was young in 1944, he didn't really have that Vincent Price effect.
No, I know. Yet. That's what I'm saying. It comes later.
But even like going back, knowing who he was with all that baggage, you go back and you watch him as a young man, and it's really easy to forget about the baggage. It's really easy to just see him as like a different person. I don't think he's quite handsome enough to play the role, because they always talk about how she just chooses Shelby because he's so handsome. I'm like, he's okay. No. I mean, he's tall, but...
Like, I'm surprised wasn't enough looker, especially for Gene Tierney.
And especially considering he was broke. It's not even like he was rich.
Yeah. And he's not even cool or anything like Mark is, and a cop at that. There is a big irony in this film, and the word dame, which I threw around in the opening, is thrown around a lot in the movie. That's a slag, of course, in our parlance, certainly now, the parlance of our times. But it's just ironic that in England, it's a sign of incredible respect. If you're knighted by the queen, or if they call it when a woman is knighted, you're a dame.
Somebody can be a lady, or someone can be a lady, you know? Mm-hmm. So in America...
I only bring it up because we haven't heard that word in a long time. We haven't done a movie like this in a long time, and it's just an unusual comparison between an insult and not an insult in one other part of the world. Now, as far as the ending, Daryl Zanuck and Otto Preminger haggled over that. Zanuck wanted it to be all in Waldo's imagination. And then Preminger won out, and Zanuck had the class to say, you were right.
And he won because they had screenings in the audience. Actually, I think it was a particular writer or somebody who was taking part in the screening. I don't understand why this was all his dream, and not McPherson, but Lydecker. What an absurd, stupid thing to do.
Well, tribute to Zanuck to use his good sense and not just say, well, I'm right because I'm the studio head.
They had this notorious feud, the two of them. Preminger got the film when Zanuck was, I think he was serving... In World War II, I'll say this wrong, William Goetz was standing in for him, and he hired Preminger to direct, and then Zanuck kicked him off and replaced him with Mamoulian before that completely fell apart, and he replaced him with Preminger again. So it was the second time he conceded to Preminger, who he considered his nemesis, for this one film, but obviously it was the right thing to do. It made a good film.
I didn't look to see if Preminger worked with Fox very much after this. Maybe he didn't. Maybe that was the last time he did
work. Yeah, maybe it was because of Zanuck.
Preminger made a lot of movies. I guess his most notable one other than this would be Anatomy of a Murder with Jimmy Stewart. And he acted in Stalag 17 as the commandant in that war comedy drama. He was a taskmaster as a director. He worked for nearly 50 years and was a producer on over 30 flicks in addition to his directing. He was nominated for Best Director for this movie. The movie wasn't as Best Picture, though. What did you think of his direction? Do you think it was good?
I love his direction. I think he obviously has a great touch with the actors. There's tons of these really masterful... long takes full of fluid camera movements, which in the 40s was a real technical accomplishment, even with black and white photography. So I think he did a great job. It's a nice, taut film. He clearly, as much as we complained about the story a little bit, but it is a very enjoyable, meaty film that's really fun to watch.
When you think about great twists in the history of movies, not many people talk about Laura, and yet when you first see the movie, I don't think many people would guess it. So obviously he did a good job of directing that you're not guessing right away, that the guy you're introduced to right away, the narrator, hey, by the way, I'm the killer, doesn't telegraph it.
Or that Laura's alive the whole time. I had the good fortune of going into the movie blind. Someone recommended it to me, lent it to me, and I watched it and had no idea what was going to happen. When she comes back into the apartment, I was completely baffled, and even more so because of his director's choice to play that moment down a lot. There's no big... reveal. There's no stop what you're doing, big musical cue, the camera focuses on her, dun, 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 it's Laura. No, she just kind of comes in, turns the lights on, and then has this confrontation with the cop who's sleeping in her apartment. It's beautifully played like that.
His writers were Jay Drattler, Samuel Hoffenstein, and Betty Reinhardt. And Ringlardner Jr., who was uncredited on this one, so he must have done some rewrites, was blacklisted later on for being a communist, supposedly. Maybe he was a communist, I don't know. And then went on to do MASH in 1970, the Robert Altman film. When you see a guy like Ringlardner Jr., who was a writer on this, uncredited, makes me think he wrote more of the screenplay than the other three people did.
You could be right.
He probably doctored a lot of it. That's going to be a thing we're going to get to in Sweet Smell of Success also.
You know what I just thought of? Because you mentioned the communist thing, and you also mentioned Dalton Trumbo earlier. Wasn't Preminger one of the first people to give Trumbo a job in the early 60s when he started Exodus. Working again? Yeah, that's right.
People are always giving Kirk Douglas credit for breaking the blacklist. And he helped, but I think Preminger actually hired Trumbo for Exodus first.
You know, the woman who wrote the novel also was, I think she was gray-listed or whatever, but she was a member of the Communist Party, Vera Caspary. Yeah, she was an off-and-on member of the Communist Party. She had a problem with the politics of the party, but she had communist ideals that got her in trouble with her career as well.
Well, all those writers based it on the 1943 novel by Vera Caspary, and the title card does say Laura. By Vera Caspary. That's it's right. Her movie, really.
It's funny, there's all these communists involved in the film when it's about all these New York elites. It's not really critical of the upper class, critical of them for being upper class. The lower class doesn't really seem to exist except for the devoted servant.
All right, behind the scenes people are the cinematographer Joseph Lachelle, who won an Oscar for this movie and then later went on to do Marty and The Apartment, so two Best Picture winners in his future. He shot a 1:33:1 print. We saw the DVD. Of course, it's black and white. It looks pretty good. It's fine. Lucien Ballard, by the way, was uncredited as a cinematographer. I didn't hear if Lachelle was fired or something happened. Sometimes that happens. A guy has another project to go into, and then somebody else takes over. But he's the guy who shot The Wild Bunch. I always remember that name, Lucien Ballard, who actually got started way back, of course, in the 40s, maybe even the 30s. The editor was Louis Loeffler. He worked with Preminger a lot, including on Anatomy of a Murder. And then the music, David Raxon, who had 90 composer credits, including being involved in Modern Times, a Chaplin film. But I didn't see anything else that comes close to Laura or Modern Times as far as being a big name title. And as we said, it is the 7th greatest music score in the history of movies, according to the AFI.
It's a jazz standard now, too. It's funny coming to the film now, that's the one thing, not Vincent Price, who comes with baggage, but the score comes with baggage, because now I've heard the song, na 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 na. It's so common, it's like this ubiquitous part of our consciousness. It's hard to imagine it just as an original soundtrack of this movie and not have it feel a little like elevator music, which it does. It's a beautiful song, but it's also something I've heard in a zillion elevators.
It's one of the funny things that people come to movies like this or Casablanca, Citizen Kane, when you know some of the things about them, the twists, the turns, the music, for example, and it has become, as you say, ubiquitous. It doesn't ruin it, but it might have been better to come to this stuff 20 years after the movie came out, or even when the movie did come out.
According to Wikipedia, there's over 100 recorded covers of the Laura theme. It is truly one of those songs that is part of the public consciousness now.
You know, I was thinking about when I was barbecuing tonight. Laura is the first name of two of the most beautiful women in the history of movies. This one with Jean Tierney, and then Dr. Zhivago, where it's Julie Christie.
Ah, yes.
And that's also a very famous music cue, Laura's theme.
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned the Vertigo influence. We talked about that plenty. The other influence I've got is a TV movie in 1968, which was written by Truman Capote, of all people, and that did not succeed at all, apparently. Any influence from you?
No. I mean, it's already came from such a rich tapestry of film noir, so it's hard to say.
Maybe the style in general, because noir was still newish at that point. It was only 3 or 4 years in. Maltese Falcons thought it was the first film noir. That was 1941.
But you can't credit Laura with innovating any of that stuff.
No, but this and Double Indemnity picked up that ball from Maltese Falcon and ran with it big time. Two of the great mystery films of that era, or of all time, in the exact same year, ironically. And that leads us to the awards and lists section, because you know the Best Picture winner that year was Going My Way.
Yeah.
And hard to believe now that Double Indemnity didn't win and Laura wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. It did win the Oscar for Lachelle's cinematography, and it was nominated for Best Director, Supporting Actor for Webb, the screenplay, and those sets you liked. Laura went into the National Film Registry in 1999 along with Streetcar Named Desire, The Wild Bunch, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Do the Right Thing, all AFI films that we covered, along with Night of the Living Dead, another black and white classic. We covered that one too. And here are the AFI lists it made, quite a few. 73rd in the top 100 of thrills. Psycho, of course, was number one. It was 7th in the music scores, we said. Star Wars was number one. And it was 4th in the mystery category of the top 100 genres. Vertigo was number one. It was also nominated for the top 100 passions, which I guess makes sense. Everyone's got passion for Laura, this poor objectified woman just trying to do her job and live a life, and yet everyone wants her.
Precious.
My precious. It was also nominated for the top 100 quotes, where Waldo says, "In my case, self-absorption is completely justified. I've never discovered any other subject so worthy of my attention." Good quote.
Oh, yeah.
It would never make the quotes list, though. It's a little too long, and it's not famous, but it's very clever writing. All right, well, then, last thoughts on Laura by Vera Caspary.
It may fall short of being a masterpiece, but it's safe to call it one of the best noir films ever made. One of my favorites.
Agreed. It's just a good thing we don't have a gun in the house.
That you know of. We do have a grandfather clock, don't we?
Neither that nor a fireplace.
No, it's true.
The next time your device downloads an Ellis episode, we're going to cover a movie that isn't even 1 year old. It was Bev's favorite film of 2016, and certainly one of my favorites also, and the Best Picture Oscar winner, La La Land. Wait, I mean Moonlight. Moonlight. It's Moonlight. It is really Moonlight. So the coming attraction trivia is a opinion piece, which I just came up with a few hours ago. Which of those two movies, La La Land and Moonlight, had the better ending? La La Land with its fantasy of what might have been, or Moonlight's tender reconciliation scene?
So, for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Moonlight. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Goodbye, Laura. Goodbye, my love.
And cut.